terms of the Minsk agreements, brokered by French President François Hollande and German Chancellor Angela Merkel. Later on Saturday, the rebels agreed to begin a pullback of heavy weapons, another key part of the negotiated truce. The moves came as the U.S. said it was considering serious sanctions against Russia following breaches of the truce. During a visit to London and consultations with his British counterpart, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry said President Obama would make a decision on the sanctions in the coming days.
So we are talking about additional sanctions, additional efforts. I'm confident that over the course of the next days, people are determined to make it clear we're not going to play this game.
Meanwhile, on Saturday, tens of thousands of protesters in Moscow gathered near Red Square to demonstrate against Ukraine's pro-Western leadership. They considered last year's revolution in Ukraine a fascist coup.
The foreign ministers of Russia, Ukraine, Germany, and France have repeated their call for the ceasefire to be respected in eastern Ukraine. Meeting in Paris on Tuesday, the ministers issued a joint statement calling for strict implementation of all the provisions in the Minsk agreements, starting with the ceasefire and withdrawal of heavy weapons.
And hello. If you've just joined us, please stay tuned for our regularly scheduled program of Indigenous Talk Radio with the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Listening to Angry Indian Radio, the podcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service.
Find us on the web, ang-newswire.blogspot.com.
Now, this minute, Spock, it takes us a little longer.
I understand the feeling, Captain.
You talk about another man's feelings. What do you feel, Spock?
My feelings are not a subject for discussion, Doctor.
Because there are no feelings to discuss.
Mr. Spock, Chekhov is dead. I see it now, and I can hardly believe it. But you work closely with him. That deserves some memorial.
Spock will have no truck with grief, Scotty. It's human.
Bones, Scotty.
Captain, it's quite all right. They forget I am half human.
Angry Indian Radio. You are listening to the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Stand up and fight for Indigenous rights.
Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
You are listening to the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Real talk for the fourth world.
Radio Intelligente Indigena.
Radio Intelligente Indigena.
Who are you? You don't know? Don't tell me Negro, that's nothing. What were you before the white man named you a Negro? And where were you? And what did you have? What was yours? And how did he take it? What gun did you see? Where is your history? How did the man wipe out your history? How did the man, what did the man do to make you as dumb as you are right now?
Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
All Indians, all over the land, all saying the same thing. This is our homeland. This is our birthright. They don't want any white man comes in here and tell us that you have to divide this up this way or that way. The white man doesn't own this land. Just because he has a gun, he said, I took your land.
Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Transmitting from within the occupied Aboriginal territories of North America to the people of the Fourth World and all ships at sea. This is Radio Intelligente Indigena.
Internet radio for the smart of the region.
Este es Aborigen Inteligente de Radio.
This is Radio Intelligente Indigena.
Labels do not make arguments. All right. There's something wrong about a man who never smiles, whose conversation never varies from the routine of the job, and who won't talk about his background.
I see.
Spock. I mean that it's odd for a non-Vulcan. The ears make all the difference.
I find your arguments strewn with gaping defects in logic.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Transmitting to the people of the Fourth World from within occupied North America, this is Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Welcome along, salutation and peace to all original human beings resident on the physical plane. You have tuned in to Indigenous news, thought, and analyses concerning issues that matter to original peoples and other communities across the world living under colonial, imperial, theological, racialist, homophobic, misogynist, neoclassist, neoliberal, neoliteral, neo-fascist, anti-environment oppression. I'm your host, Angry Indian, editor-in-chief of the Aboriginal Press News Service, blogging to the Fourth World from aboriginalnewswire.tumblr.com and aboriginalpress.wordpress.com and our main news portal, ang-newswire.blogspot.com. And along with my executive producer and studio engineer, Ms. Guadalupe Morales, we welcome you to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Yeah, before we go into the show any further, I want to, there's a couple of things I want to say. I'm not really comfortable doing this, but I'm going to do it anyway. Joan Rodriguez, or Joni Rodriguez, otherwise known on Twitter, at Joni399. If you've been following me at The Angry Indian for any period of time, you have seen, or if you are, you know, dealing in any way, shape, or form on Twitter and on Facebook with the issue, the subject, the travesty that is Leonard Peltier and the way he is being treated by the United States government. It is what it is. You know, we know what it is. It's complete hypocrisy in terms of, you pick your Chinese anti-communist activist that gets, full support from the United States government, for the United States corporate media, from the United States business community, from the journalists, you know, from what's supposed to be the overseers of the democracy. When you see that, and then you take into account, you know, every 28 hours, and, you know, that's what African people in terms of dealing with police brutality and what have you, and you look at more than 1,000, you know, First Nations sisters who are missing, Indigenous women who are missing on the border, you know, the Canadian-U.S. border. And then you think about the Indigenous women who are missing from the Mexican-U.S. border. And, Leonard, you know, in many ways connects these struggles. I don't want to go on too many tangents about this. And this, like I said, this is difficult for me for a lot of reasons. Because, one, you know, I never actually met Joan. And when we first, you know, kind of came into contact with each other, again, this is all via Twitter now. This is the new activism, you dig? We didn't get along. You know, it was really tense, and things actually at some point got personal. Now, I can't remember specifically, and it's not important now anyway, if she made personal remarks, but, you know, it wasn't cool. And this was over the Elizabeth Warren claim to be Native. you know, I don't know. You know, she could be. I mean, you know, so many people are. You know, it, again, that I'm being redundant with this, but it is what it is. And you know, my position then, as it is now, and as far as I'm concerned, I was proven correct because, you know, while there was a lot of attention, you know, from a lot of Native activists, and really, I can't even really say it was a lot. It, you know, it was probably a lot of talk. But, you know, in all, you know, for all kinds of purposes, you know, this was a small group of people on Twitter that I got into. And again, I'm going to say this because it's true. You know, the record is out there, whoever the hell these two accounts were. It got nasty. You know, I was accused of being gay, as if something is wrong with that. Not by her, but by two people on the, well, this particular hashtag. Well, there's a lot of hashtags, but there's this particular hashtag. NDNZ Indians, right? You know, where these people were basically saying that I, when we had no problem before, were you know, was trying to take over their hashtag, because I didn't know that people owned the hashtag, but that, you know, I took over their hashtag, you know, in order to you know, push what, fake Indians. And obviously I had to be one. And then I was accused of being black and not native, which still is to show that, you know, racism within Native, you know, Native America exists. Which we all know that anyway. You gotta do is look at Oklahoma and the fucking Cherokee decision. I mean, shit. But you know, in any case, you know, her and I did not get along on that. And she was very, very anti-Elizabeth Warren over this. And, yeah, you know, she was one of the people that was leading, you know, a bit of a campaign, you know, against me. But, you know, I you know, I'm not one to take bullshit from anybody. If you remember what happened with that, you know, cat from Thailand, you know, a white cat from Thailand, you know, I'm not, you know, into taking bullshit from anybody. They were wrong on that issue. And, you know, not just her, a whole lot of other people. They were wrong on that issue. They were politically wrong on that issue. You know, I didn't judge them as individuals. And this is what I'm talking about here, because see, all, you know, majority of those other folks, and I'm not going to name them, you know, because this one, he's a comedian. He wasn't particularly kind either, but see, he was wrong too. And you know, when you really look at everything, when you really look at it, you know, the types of insults that, you know, that were personally leveled against me, you know, didn't change the fact that Elizabeth Warren, well, she might be, she might not goddamn be, but to go ahead and help the Republicans with this without realizing that you were helping the Republicans by trying to, you know, sideline her while she's trying to fight Wall Street to a degree, because she's pro-Israel. So, you know, we need to ding her on that. But the thing is, she was going against Wall Street because, well, look at what the fuck the state of the country is in, and it's due to Wall Street. And, you know, a lot of folks cannot see the bigger picture. But what I'm trying to talk about now in terms of Joan is we were able to get past that. You dig? We were able to get past that because, you know, I continued, because she's like, you know how, look, we all know how Native people are. We're very conservative. And when we've usually made up, you know, our mind about you, it doesn't, you know, it doesn't matter what you do. But in our case, we've never met. So I could see from all of her activity, at least on Twitter. I don't fuck with Facebook, but, you know, on Twitter, you know, Lupe does, and Lupe says she saw repostings of her stuff. But, you know, what I'm talking about is I continue to repost her data. And people were asking me, you know, why would you do that, being that, you know, you had this contentious, what I said, but that's, you know, her and I are not the issue. You know, Leonard, and the bigger question of what is happening to Leonard is the issue. So I continue to post her work. So it took, I don't know, it was a while. You know, I didn't count the days, I didn't count the weeks, I didn't count the months. But, you know, it was a while before she at some point became cordial. And, you know, we never discussed it. I never brought it up. On how we were, but you know, the point is, and what I'm trying to say is out here to my brothers and sisters, is that we may not necessarily agree on specific issues. we may not necessarily agree about individuals in the movement, right? But we need to do so respectfully. And, you know, one of the reasons, you know, and I'm not saying this, and I know there are people, you know, perhaps even her family, and again, this is not my intent to, you know, bring this up and try to make some kind of hay out of this, you know, now that we have learned that she's passed on, that she's transitioned. No, you know, I think, you know, as an activist, as a true activist, she would appreciate the fact that, you know, I'm mentioning our relationship. I'm talking about our relationship. You know, anyone who takes this as a personal knock of this woman, you can kiss my motherfucking beautiful brown ass, because that's not what this shit is about. And, you know, and it's fucked up that you have to preface things like that. But you have to nowadays, because you have a lot of fucking folks, man. You know, all they see is the fucking negative. And what I'm saying about Joan is, you know, unlike these other yahoos and shit who, you know, got on this anti-Elizabeth Warren thing and then realized late that they were actually helping the Republicans by not looking into why they were going after her ass in the fucking first place. You know, her and I were able to get past that. And I could see that she was out there stumping for Leonard, and she could see that I was doing what I was doing, and we moved forward. Now, if it was possible for Joan Rodriguez and us to be able to do that, we never met each other, but we were still able to be diplomatic and to, in the end, support each other, you know, in terms of our activism, you know, and I'm saying that, you know, sincerely, you know, go through the, you know, go through my messages. I believe, you know, in at least one direct message, you know, because she became a supporter of this podcast / pirate radio program. You know, she helped promote this show. And I kind of suspect that the last show, you know, Luke, you know, really in some ways probably didn't do as well because she didn't, you know, she's not here, you know, to talk about it. But, you know, because a lot of folks don't listen to the show because they realize or they say, you know, oh, well, they're indigenous, but they're not Indian, right? They're not Native American, so I don't give a fuck, you know. I mean, we used to have some listeners at Haskell University. You know, we don't anymore, you know, from what I understand. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. But I know that she was our connection to the North American indigenous community, otherwise known as Indian country, right, colloquially. And, you know, we do appreciate her for that. And we appreciate, and I appreciate individually, you know, everything that she's been able to do in terms of Leonard, in terms of missing indigenous women on the American, well, what the fuck, this is all America, man, on the United States-Canadian border, you dig? You know, I really don't know what else to say. And, you know, and one of these things, you know, one of the reasons why this is bothering, because, you know, there's a couple of people that have passed on that, you know, I have thoughts about that I've never actually met. The co-founder of the Aboriginal News Group, Professor Ridwan Laher, has, you know, he passed last year. No one saw it coming. You know, it was just one of those things. And, you know, he was very busy. He was in Africa. He was educating all over the place. And he was doing what he could to, you know, try to intellectually stem the extremism that was rising, that he saw rising in the Muslim world, you know, as a devout follower of Islam. You know, he was out there trying to, you know, do the right thing and support humanity in all of his forms. And it's just really crummy, you know, when you have to consider that, you know, we were all talking about the Aboriginal News Group. At one point, we were talking about meeting in Africa, you know. And that's not going to happen, you know, for a lot of reasons. But, you know, with him not being around, for me to be able to lean on, you know, it's always been kind of tough in the management of what we do here. And, you know, I mean, this does a lot of problems, you know, in terms of communications. Cena Brown Davis and I, you know, our relationship has been strained because of, you know, communications, not being able to communicate. You know, a lot of people have been trying to email me, hasn't been able to happen. And yeah, I'm going on a tangent and I apologize about that because that's not my intent. We were talking about Joni. And I'm pointing out that, you know, it's tough for me to do this, to talk about this, because I knew her, but I didn't know her. You dig what I'm saying? You know, we never met. But this is the 21st century, and this is how it goes. But we definitely work for each other. And one of the things that gets me about it is she said in our direct message, after all that hassle that we had had before, and then going through that period of where we were supporting each other, you know, out of principle, and then supporting each other because we could see what the other one was doing. You know, I mean, one of the last messages I got from her was, I love your show. And thank you for what you do, and words to that effect. And she had done that a couple of times. And, you know, in I wanted to say something to her, you know. And I put a shout out on Twitter. I put a few shout outs, you know. I wanted to hear from other Native people about this, you know, on Twitter, who, you know. And you always find out what's going on when you pass, man. You know, when people pass away, you know, you find out who your real family is, and you find out who your real friends were, you know. The only problem is you're not here to actually realize any of this. But, you know, I cared for Joni. You know, I was down with her because I could see she was down for the people. And, you know, whatever, you know, differences of opinion we had, it was just that. They were differences of opinion. You know, her and I were two human beings, and we dealt with each other as human beings. And we were looking to see what we could do through this internet medium as human beings to support other human beings. So, you know, it's like I said, it's tough, you know, because Ridwan Laha, I never got a chance to meet him, you know. The first person I actually interviewed, it was an email interview when I first started doing this sort of thing, Native Joe. Some of you remember Native Joe. He passed on, you know, and it was really tough when his wife went online and was like, hey, you know, Joe has passed on, you know, no one saw it coming. It's always difficult, and it's more difficult when you haven't met the person, because, you know, when I was debating whether or not I should actually say anything, and then I started going on Twitter and looking for people to make comments, you know, on the original posting about her passing, you know, she's been a supporter, a strong supporter of Leonard Peltier for years. And he had heard of her work eventually. And the notice said that he was told of her passing. And, you know, I'm sure it had to affect him, knowing that someone that he never met, someone that he had never physically connected to. I mean, as far as I know, he doesn't have email, you know. So there's no way, unless they wrote to each other, that he directly connected with her. And I'm not aware that he did. But the point was, they had a connection. She believed in the struggle, and she believed in him as an individual, and she could see, you know, the suffering and the sacrifice that this man and his family have made. And she felt that, you know, she could do something. She had a keyboard in front of her, an internet connection, and access to a browser. And she decided to do something for someone that she never met, that she never knew. And, you know, it's hard not to choke back tears, knowing that there are people who give a damn. You know, that there are real people out here who care. Because a lot of us, you know, we get really arrogant sometimes, and we think that, you know, we're the only activists in the motherfucking world. You know, we're the only activists in town. And, you know, that's not true. You know, just because a lot of folks do not wave a, you know, a placard or wave a banner, that doesn't mean that they're not, say, you know, when people say fucked up things at work or fucked up things on public transport or what have you, that that, you know, they don't say anything. They don't stand up. I mean, I've seen folks that I didn't think were political at all who really were not political. They just saw someone in trouble and they decided to say something about it. They decided to do something about it. And if there's anything to be remembered about Joan Rodriguez, is that, you know, she didn't have to say or do a fucking thing. You dig what I'm saying? She could have just lived her life, man. And it seems that she spent a lot of her, you know, psychic, spiritual effort in trying to help Leonard and trying to help her sisters that are being abused and taken apart on these borders. So, you know, I just want, you know, everyone to, you know, if you take the time to take the time, I mean to say, you know, go on Twitter and look at the Twitter feed of Joni399. I'm not exactly sure what her Facebook data is, but I'm sure if you look around, you know, hard enough, you'll find it and you can see what's going on. You know, I want everybody to check it out and to see what, you know, what she was about. And, you know, as we're going out here, you know, one of the other things was that, you know, Leonard Nimoy has passed. And I had absolutely no connection to Leonard Nimoy, you know. Never emailed each other, never had any contact, you know, none of that. But like a lot of people my age group, grew up watching him, you know, on Star Trek. You know, the odd man out. As a Jew of Russian extraction, there might have been some of that in his personality. I can't say for sure. I don't know enough about his personal life. I never really knew, never really tried to find out. You know, I'm not a Trekkie or Trekker, as I was corrected earlier this afternoon. It's, you know, the reason I'm mentioning, you know, I'm mentioning Mr. Nimoy is that, you know, for those of us who are mixed, who grew up with Star Trek, it was, I'm not going to sit here and say liberating, because that would be bullshit, but it was certainly something important, because, you know, for a lot of us, we didn't see too many African people on television, which is the other reason why Star Trek was important, because of Michelle Nichols. It was important for us to see, it was good for us to see Negroes in space, I suppose, Asians in space, right, young Russians in space, Scots in space, and what have you, and, you know, all well and good. But the thing about Spock was that, you know, unlike a lot of the other crew who was supposed to be whatever it is that they were, you know, Asian, African, whatever, you know, Spock was mixed. And he wasn't, you know, so much racially mixed. You know, this cat had Vulcan and human DNA. So it was a big deal because he was, you know, always caught in between worlds, right? And, you know, I mean, for a lot of people who are mixed, who, you know, somewhat isolated in xenophobic environments, Mr. Spock was a very important character, a very important cultural reference. So, you know, that's where I'm coming from. You know, I mean, there's some white gay men who were telling me this morning that that was their big thing about Spock. You know, as young men, and the show came on in the 60s, and they were starting to understand their, you know, their sexuality. They said, yeah, you know, Spock being ambiguous in many ways, except for his, you know, intellect, because, you know, logic is logic. You know, it is what it is. 1 + 1 is still going to add up to 2, no matter where the fuck you go in the universe. Yeah, I know. I've had some arguments with some black Islamic Hebrews who were trying to tell me that there's some other type of fucking mathematics and shit, that fuck them and fuck anybody that comes up in any type of bullshit like that. Yeah, I think it's nonsense. But, yeah, so having said that, we're going to take a slight break, and then we're going to come back with the rest of the show. And, yeah, so let's do this. This is Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Please stay tuned.
This is Zesh9 from Zesh9.com, and you're listening to the Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
They didn't have to tell us. They don't know who shot the agents. The whole record shows they don't know who shot the agents. And they don't want anybody else to know, because they want the world to believe that Leonard Peltier is guilty, because they have staked their reputation on it. He's been in much too long. It's not that he ought to be out now. He should never have been in the first place. Never. The President of the United States can commute that sentence in the name of justice any moment he wants to. He has the power, complete and absolute, under the Constitution. And every day is a new crime. Every dawn is a new crime. Every dusk is a new crime against the dignity of the Indian peoples. Because while Leonard Peltier is in prison, we all are.
Hello, I'm Carol Gordon. Inform yourself about Plan B emergency contraception. Information can be the best protection, especially dealing with asexual assault or unprotected sex. If you are 17 or older, you do not need a prescription to receive Plan B. All Indian Health Service facilities should carry Plan B, but most don't. This is a violation of your reproductive rights. Call your local Indian Health Service unit and ask for Plan B. It is our right as Native women to receive Plan B. This message is brought to you by the Native American Women's Health Education Resource Center.
Radio Insurgente, la voz de los sin voz.
Vamos, 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 vamos adelante, para que salgamos en la lucha avante, porque nuestra patria grita y necesita de todo el esfuerzo de los zapatistas.
Transmitiendo desde algún lugar de las montañas del sureste mexicano, en la frecuencia 97.9 en FM.
Yo, what's up? My name is Jasiri X, you know what I'm saying? And I'm really responding to the call, man, of my sister Rosa Clemente, you know what I'm saying, for Men in Hip Hop. Really stand up and say, like, rape under no circumstances is acceptable. You know what I'm saying? Rape shouldn't be rapped about. It shouldn't be supported. You know what I'm saying? And I'm really feeling like, you know, especially after Rick Ross came out today and said what he said, you know, he didn't use the word rape, but he described a scenario in which, you know, he put something in a woman's drink and had sex with her and she didn't consent. If you have sex with a woman and she didn't consent, that's rape. And we have to say no to rape. And beyond Rick Ross, whether it's Fox News or their viewers attacking Zelina Maxwell for asking men to stop raping women, whether it's Hollywood, you know, perpetuating, you know, this rape culture, you know, it's got to stop. It's really, you know, we got to take personal responsibility as men. My name is Jasiri X. This is One Hood.
You've painted up your lips and rolled and curled your tinted hair. Ruby, are you contemplating going out somewhere? The shadows on the wall tell me the sun is going down. Don't take your love to town. It wasn't me that started that old crazy Asian war, but I was proud to go and do my patriotic chore. And though it's true that I'm not the man I used to be, I still need your company. It's hard to love a man whose legs have been paralyzed. And and the wants and the needs of a woman your age, Ruby Ivy lies. But it won't be long, I've heard them say, until I'm not around. Don't take your love to town. She's leaving now, 'cause I just heard the slamming of the door. The way I know, I've heard it slam 100 times before. If I could move, I'd get my gun and put her in the ground. Don't take your love to town. For God's sakes, turn around.
Hi, this is Willie Nelson from Normal. For 30 years, Normal has provided a voice for the millions of Americans who smoke marijuana responsibly. Thousands of sick and dying patients find marijuana effective as a medicine, including cancer, MS, and AIDS patients. 9 states have legalized its use. To learn how you can help, contact Normal at www.norml.org or call toll-free at 888-67-NORML.
You are listening to the Angry and Unintelligent Aboriginal Radio.
My name is Gordon Hill from the Pukwak York Nation in northwest coast of so-called British Columbia, Canada, and you're listening to Radio Intelligent Indigenous.
Okay, welcome back. This is Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. We are broadcasting out of Polandia, Oregon. And, you know, we're here again to talk about, for the most part, and I'm being straight up with you, we're talking about nothing. You know, I have no agenda this evening because there's just so much happening. And frankly, I'm tired about talking about the same fucking thing, you know, because it's redundant. I'm going to be straight up, everybody. I really don't have anything specific to talk about. We all know that Netanyahu is a fucking liar. I thought that was common knowledge. You know, I don't understand what the big deal is in why there's a lot of surprise that Mossad, his own fucking intelligence service, has decided that Netanyahu is full of bookus, that he is probably other than Lieberman over there. I'm not talking about Holy Joel Lieberman on this side of the water. I'm talking about Agudal. You know, that son of a bitch they got over there in the Knesset. The one we're talking about, you know, Palestine doesn't exist. Got to get rid of Palestine. All Arabs are bad. So, everybody knew this. Everybody knew this. This is not new news. This is not really a big fucking surprise. Everybody knew that the Netanyahu government was fucking full of it, that they were lying about Iran. Not to say that Iran is the garden spot of the world. You know, I mean, and even then, really, I mean, what the fuck? Really? Who? What is it? Israel's going to talk about human rights in terms of Iran? Are they serious? Is the United States going to talk about, you know, human rights in terms of Iran? Really? Is the UK? Really? Is Canada? Really? Germany? They, you know, I mean, they just had, what was it, Hans Fromm. Hans Fromm. He was their goddamn number one intelligence man. He quit. Why did he quit? He left under a cloud. Why did he leave under a cloud? He left under a cloud because it turns out that the fucking Federal Intelligence Service was fucking supporting, for goddamn more than a decade, neo-Nazis running around doing murders, doing attacks, arsons, all throughout Germany, killing people, killing Turks, attacking immigrants, attacking homosexuals, attacking Jews. You know, no. Why should we take anything that any conservative says seriously, anywhere? And I'm not talking about political party. I said conservative.
I didn't say political party. Listen to what I'm saying, because, you know, a lot of what the, you know, is said on this show gets taken out of context. I said conservative. I'm talking about the far right. Now, we have people in the far... I just mentioned Holy Joe Lieberman out of Connecticut, right? You know, this is the fellow who was the mentor to Barack Obama. Think about that for a moment. You know, see, the Republicans always talk a lot of bullshit. How come they never point that one out? You know, while they're trying to say that, yeah, well, he's a Muslim. Well, you know, that's bullocks. You know, full goddamn well, but Barack Obama is not a fucking Muslim. And if he is a Muslim, he's one of the worst ever. I mean, he's doing so much goddamn damage to the fucking Muslim world, it's not funny. So, you know, you can't pay these goddamn nutcases on the far right any motherfucking, you know, they're not worth a grain of salt in terms of the truth. You know, because to them, truth is a fucking perception. It has nothing to do with the fucking reality of the day. All right? It has nothing to do with a clear and cold, you know, retrospective on your past, you know, as a nation, as a culture, as a society, or even as an individual. You know, the idea of any introspection, be it, you know, personal, be it natural, you know, national, be anything, is just, you know, it's foreboding. You can't do it. There's a lot of talk about it, but it's not real. It's not fucking real. You know, there's a lot of pretense in the fucking entire Anglophone world. And I apologize for not really having anything specific to say. But, you know, it's been a while since I've goddamn done anything. You know, because it, you know, she had to drag me in here. Because, you know, we spend money on this show in terms of... Yeah, she's right. Yeah, okay, look, I need to be more specific. When I say that we're spending money on the show, you know, actually this studio that we use here, like I said, this is a cooperative artistic space down here in Portlandia. And what is cool about it, you know, in Southeast, if you really want to, you know, really want to know, you know, what's not too far from Reed College, actually. What you really need to understand as far as how this goes and why we're able to do it at all with the limited resources that we have is that we run an open source program. And what I mean by an open source program is that all of the software and, you know, a great deal of the music, if it's not Creative Commons, it's open source somehow. And, you know, everything that she uses, all of the software she uses to record the program, to edit the program, right? You know, we have a space here and there's computers here and so on. And there's a particular setup that we run Linux on, which is an open source operating system. So we use all of these resources plus what you see on the net in terms of the blogs, because I just listed them off, right? Now, our first and our main news portal is ang-newswire.blogspot.com, which, of course, is hosted by Google. AboriginalNewsWire.tumblr.com, which I believe is owned outright by Yahoo now, because they wanted to get into what Google was doing. And then, of course, there's the old reliable WordPress at WordPress.com, and you can find us there at AboriginalPress.wordpress.com. And you might actually want to look at the blogs. I know, I believe we mentioned it on WordPress.com, that there's a bug in the WordPress.com architecture for the software. So if you use WordPress, as we do, you might want to check that out. Whether you use it on .com or you go to .org and you actually get the architecture for your site. Whatever you do. You know, freeware, open source, it's out there. And I want to say this too, since we're on the goddamn subject, because it came up in the conversation I had just yesterday. If you're a fucking Republican, if you're a goddamn capitalist, what the fuck are you using open source for? Buy goddamn Microsoft or buy a fucking Mac. Leave the rest of us the fuck alone. And if you're going to continue to use this shit, then start to fucking really look at your goddamn politics, because you're a fucking hypocrite. And I mean that from the bottom of my pea-picking fucking indigenous heart. You know, I really get tired of motherfuckers that want to talk all this capitalism shit, capitalism shit, capitalism, and then they get an idea for a fucking business, and then they want to crowdsource it.
I'm sorry, but I think that's just some hypocritical bullshit. You know, you want to crowdsource a goddamn capitalist private motherfucking enterprise, but then you want to cut people off from welfare and shit? Fuck you, man. Fuck you, man. That's my agenda. Fuck you to the hypocrites, okay? Fuck you to all the goddamn hypocrites, man. For real. I mean, really, you know, I was supposed to, because I got, you know, really. No, seriously, it's like, as I said last show, it's really redundant to come in here and talk about all these terrible things that are happening. And, excuse me, and frankly, I don't even talk about the real fucked up shit. You know, like, I'm not out here talking about white phosphorus. I'm not talking about genocide per se. Right, you know, even though we all goddamn know what's going on all over the fucking place, I'm talking about real genocide, not this bullshit white genocide, and that is complete goddamn bullshit. Yeah, man, really. You know, I've, you know, she writes these things out, and you know, I sit here and I try to read them out, but you know, by the time I've sat down, you know, we've talked about several things that are related to this, but then, you know, it's kind of like being on Wikipedia, right? You know, you read one thing and then it just leads you for more information and you can just get caught up, actually. So, you know, which it says something about Wikipedia that, who gives a fuck, right? No, on the strength, I really, really don't know where to go. You know, I don't know where to go anymore. You know, where does one go with this type of, you know, chaos? I mean, there's so many goddamn bad things happening out here, and I really don't know where to go, what the fuck to do, you know, just like you, you know, for some of the people that I bump into in the mornings when I'm getting coffee who listen to the show, you know, they ask me, like, well, you know, what can we do? And it's like, I know just as much as you do. You know, because a lot of it is preaching to the fucking choir. I mean, we all know that, you know, things are unfair, that there's a lot of people that are not eating, and we know why. We know that there's no need for all of this fucking military funding. We know that there's no need for spies every goddamn where. We know that there's no motherfucking need for cop shows and television dramas like MI5 and all this type of shit and Alias. We know that this is all propaganda. And that these movies are all pushing propaganda and a meme, you know, the security thing. I mean, we're looking at fascism all the fucking time, and it's become popular entertainment. You know, what are these young guys talking about here? Equilibrium? Yeah, that's one film, right? And then you have all of these other, you know, I mean, you can go on and on. Full Metal Jacket, you know, which you can look at that, the Kubrick film, you can look at that as an anti-war film if you want to. Strangelove was an anti-war film, but you know, Platoon you can look at as an anti-war film, but then it encouraged a lot of motherfuckers to sign up too, you know. It's you know, it's really crazy. But then again, when Dances of Wolves came out, everybody told me they were Native. Everybody. I mean, it was like everybody I knew claimed to have a Cherokee great-great-grandma, you know, a princess, right? You know, it was just all over the place. You know, so why? Because they saw the film, and then there was this meme. And then right around that time, the whole Northwest Pattern thing came out, which was probably inspired by the release of the film. You know, look, you know, none of these things happen by goddamn accident. You know, and I suppose this is, you know, we want to talk about propaganda, adverts, subliminal messaging, and then you look at this crazy bullshit that Netanyahu just tried to fucking pull off. And he's still going to pull it off. I mean, he's still going to do the whole Congress shit. And it doesn't matter that, you know, John Boehner Boner is trying to undermine his own goddamn president, his own fucking government, his own fucking country, basically, by bringing in, you can't even really say that he's a foreign leader, can you? Can you really say that Netanyahu's a foreign fucking leader? Didn't he grow up in Philly? Isn't that what you and your husband, Luke? He and I both have heard that he's from Philly and Ron Dermer's from Miami, right? Or is he from Philly too? No, I think he's from Florida. But Netanyahu,
he went to school and he's from the suburbs, man. So it's like, is he really a foreign leader? I mean, when you take into account the amount of fucking welfare, and that's what it is. You know, it's like when businesses get money. You know, they call it a subsidy. That's bullshit. It's fucking welfare. Welfare. You know, it's fucking welfare that regular taxpayers are fucking paying. But then they can't get any goddamn thing. But the banks got help. They got their money back. And they made a fucking profit. GM got their motherfucking money back. And they made a motherfucking profit. What did you get, brothers and sisters? What did you get? You know, I know I didn't get any goddamn thing. And then I'll get somebody who is 100% pro-Obama, who would tell me, you know, usually black, or, you know, a hardcore fucking progressive, and will be like, well, you got Obamacare. And it's like, that wasn't a fucking gift. The goddamn, you know, Affordable Care Act was drawn up by the Republicans. It was drawn up by the Heritage Foundation. Everybody fucking knows this. Everybody fucking knows this. You know, the idea that it's mandated that everybody has to pay for it instead of just having it taken out of taxes or added to taxes, is to make it a separate bill to force people to pay to buy fucking insurance instead of just providing it the way you're supposed to goddamn do in the 21st century? No. The fuck do people tell me, oh, it's a socialist plan? It's like, what the fuck are you talking about? And like I said, this is why I get so goddamn boring in many ways. Not that I don't want to talk to you folks, but, you know, really, it's like, you know, what am I supposed to say? You know, what can I possibly say that would be any different than what Glenn Greenwald is saying? And I leave it to Glenn Greenwald to articulate what he's doing in terms of surveillance, in terms of that, because he does it better than I do. I mean, I know the details, and I talk about what I know, you know, but he does it better than I do, so I leave it to him. You know, I mean, there's a lot of folks that are like, well, how come you don't have Black Agenda Report on? Well, frankly, I mean, I'd be down to have them on, but they're doing their own thing. And, you know, they have a specific socialist agenda. I don't. I mean, their analysis is out there and so on. And I'm not saying that it shouldn't be out there. But, you know, they come from a specific, I mean, literally, a specific socialist perspective. I don't. You know, I mean, Marxism is a part of how I might break, you know, deconstruct or break things down. Because it is a way to look at capitalism, especially capitalism in Europe during the industrial period and what we're still dealing with. But just like anything else, I mean, it's a filter. You know, Lenin took what he needed from Marxism and did what he needed to do to make it work for Russians, because technically it shouldn't have worked for Russians at that time. Not at that time, you know, it shouldn't have. Not at that time. I mean, he wasn't even in Russia when the fucking thing happened. You know, I mean, it was the rank and file. A lot of goddamn anarchists that had started the actual fucking Russian Revolution in October. He just came in intellectually, and because people knew who he was and there was already some sort of organization, he was able to get to the podium before somebody else. Like a Marchenko, right? I believe I'm pronouncing his name correctly, the Russian anarchist. Who they ended up hunting down, actually, Lenin and Trotsky. You know, they hunted down the anarchists, man, because the anarchists were saying, hey, you know, it's like Rosa Luxemburg. This isn't really the revolution that we were going for. But see, but at the same time, you know, where Greenwald might talk about this in terms of, say, bringing up the Stasi or what led to the Stasi in terms of the type of surveillance that we're in, for an example, right, and how this would lead to Edward Snowden and so on, and it's all relevant. You know, I will make the argument that if the expeditionary forces from the United States, Britain, Germany, and France hadn't invaded the Soviet Union, you know, in 1917, you know, perhaps Lenin wouldn't have been as brutal. But then again, you know, we're talking about Russian society and Russian culture, and Russian society and Russian culture is, it is what it is. You dig what I'm saying? And, you know, just like there's always been this belief, not by me, but by those in the intelligence services, because, you know, they go on television and they make their statements and they make their quoted by the New York Times and what have you.
that, hey, you know, I mean, what happened? Norman Schwarzkopf, right? The son of the other Norman Schwarzkopf, the Iranian man, you know, part of the coup against Mossadegh, right? Because, you know, Norman Schwarzkopf, general, Storm and Norman, he grew up in Iran. You think they just picked his name up out of a hat when it came to Desert Storm and all that? No. And after they beat them in Kuwait, which used to belong to Iraq, actually, look at an old map. You know, after World War One, dude. Because the British had set all of this up. He was ready to press on and get rid of the entire Hussein government. Go straight to Baghdad. This is on public... This is a matter of the public record. And, you know, what ended up happening? He was ordered by the Bush administration, Bush the First, right? Pappy Bush, not to proceed, if anything, to go, I believe it was North Iraq, and support the Iraq government against the rebels, against the Kurds. And I still remember reading in BloombergNews.com that Saddam Hussein was found, not in a goddamn sewer pipe by some Marines, but he was captured by Kurds who had held him for 3 days because they were trying to get their own Kurdistan and they were trying to negotiate and it didn't work. Because I remember also reading, and it might have been the New York Times, General Powell, Colin Powell, you know, before he lied about what ended up happening later when he was Secretary of State, lying in the UN using a university student's thesis to make a point on why we need to go and do war. Well, we mean we. That implies that I have something to do with this. No, I have absolutely nothing to do with this. I am an observer like you. If I am a participant, it is only because it is reluctant. You know, because I am... You know, I'm an American. You know, what does that mean any goddamn more? You know, well, what did it ever really fucking mean? Really? What did it ever really fucking mean? You know, when I hear the American people, you know, what does that mean, the American people? Who the fuck are they talking about? What does that mean, the American people? You know, if everybody in North America was actually a people, we wouldn't have a fucking race problem, would we? We would definitely have class disparities, but it wouldn't be along ethnic lines, would it? If the United States actually had a people. The United States is a goddamn, you know, colonialist wonder kind that grew too fucking fast for its own fucking good. You know, I mean, it's kind of like, why am I going with this? But the cat that Patrick McGoohan, personal hero of mine, for a lot of reasons, hardcore Catholic, believe it or not, but in any case, one of the most radical sons of bitches that ever fucking lived, right? And his show The Prisoner used a penny farthing bicycle as a symbol of the concept of the show, and a lot of folks never really understood that, and I didn't either until I saw something that explained it. But what it came down to was, you know, he as a Catholic believed that, you know, technology was going a little too fast. Not that he was against technology. He was just saying that spiritually, humans, or people, really. You talk about humans as a species or humans as an emotional thing, right? Humanity, right? Dig, people, right? Because there's the difference. You know, there's humanity and then there's people. And then there's you. You know, and many individuals that represent these groups, that represent the people, they were not particularly keen on, say, slowing progress down just a little bit so, like, people could catch up. I mean, they've already seriously talking about artificial intelligence literally controlling things so that you don't have to. You know, and it's not even a matter of your body getting soft. Your fucking mind gets soft because you're not thinking anymore. You don't have to fucking think. You know, you don't have to do anything. So, you know, let the drones do it for you. Right? Let the droids do it for you. And for, you know, for those of you who are into science fiction, I know we've been talking about that a lot lately. You know, I mean, you got a THX 1138, and I'll talk about that, right? And then you got your damn near neo-Nazi Robert Heinlein, right? Because, you know, most science fiction writers, you know, are conservatives, if not arch-conservatives.
I was going to say Ray Harryhausen, but that's not who I'm talking about. He was a special effects man. The cat that wrote Fahrenheit 451. And, you know, I didn't know that he was a bigot. I really didn't. I didn't know that he was misogynist. I didn't know anything about him as an individual. I just read his stories. Ray Bradbury. You know, one of the reasons I actually, as a schoolboy, wanted to write, because I had read Fahrenheit 451 and a few other things from him. And at that time, I was also into Isaac Asimov. So, you know, I would, iRobot, that type of thing. So I would read that, and I'd say, yeah, you know, the future, this, that, you know, hovercraft, you know, all of these things, and science, and the whole idea of DNA and RNA, and, you know, like the idea of tattooing your serial number and all that kind of thing. You know, I thought that all of this would be the future, that, you know, my medical information would be there, and I could always be identified in case something happened. You know, all of these things that at the time, you know, were presented to us as being very glossy, right? And then here it is, you know, real sci-fi shows you all the negatives of this shit. So, yeah, you can go to space or go into outer space. You can leave the territorial domain, right? Break from the atmosphere if that's possible, to get through the Van Allen belts and shit, through all that fucking radiation, space dust, flying dots, you know, all of that shit you would run into if you're actually flying through the motherfucking through the void. And you can go, you know, to all the worlds and all this kind of shit, you know, if that's even possible. Because frankly, I don't know. Not what? Now we're gonna talk about UFOs? I mean, how many more tangents can I fucking go on? Because I know I'm going on tangents, but it's like I said, I had nothing to talk about. Because, you know, I mean, what am I gonna say? That the world is fucked up? We all know that the world is fucked up. How many times? I'm not gonna do a Howard Beale, man. But, you know, yeah, people have asked me, you know, Coffee and One, you know, what is this show about, man? You know, sometimes you're rambling. You're right. I'm rambling right the fuck now. I am. Because, you know, I'm at a crossroads intellectually with myself. Because, you know, how does one remain without trying to be rude to people, without trying to be unpleasant, without, you know, necessarily having yourself removed from social situations, or, you know, where people don't want to invite you because you're going to talk about things and remind them that, okay, you know, you got an unlimited fucking credit card. Matter of fact, you got three of them and shit, but, you know, we just passed three homeless goddamn people. Who are they going to even eat tonight, let alone even have some place to stay in this environment? Sleeping in the rough. And, you know, a lot of folks don't want to hear that. And, yeah, I can understand that. I don't blame them. You know, they go to work, they do their 9-to-5 or whatever the fuck it is they do, or whatever their hustles are. And they're making money. And, you know, they get this motherfucking... they get this idea that, you know, I have enough right now to not worry about it. So I'm just not going to worry about it. And it's like, what do you mean by that? You say, I'm just not going to worry about it. I said, well, what happens when your cards run out? And he goes, well, then I'll look at it differently. And hey, at least he was fucking honest about it. He's like, hey, when it starts to bother me, when it starts to fuck with me, when it starts to become a problem for me, then I will fucking be concerned. But in the meantime, I don't give a shit. Right? And, you know, for example, I'm old enough when this happened with AIDS. You know, how many people said, well, I don't know anybody gay. I'm not gay. It's not my problem. How many black people said that for years? Not my problem. That's a faggot's problem. How many Native Americans have been saying that shit? Not my problem. It's a faggot's problem. Right? You know, until somebody they know gets burned. Then that person wants to drag you to every meeting. They want you to read every pamphlet. They want you to attend every rally. They want you to help with the fundraising. But when it was your friend, when it was, you know, say like your best friend's partner, or your cousin's partner, you know, somebody that you are close to who is in a relationship with somebody who is dealing with this. You know, when you tried to get their attention to say, well, hey, you know, they didn't want my friend's friend to, or my friend's partner, because you got to remember, you know, back then people were not calling their same-sex spouse, husband, wife, or what have you, you know. Everybody, you know, they were together 18, 22 years, friends. His friend. That's how things were referred to. And, you know, and I would, you know, say, hey, you know, so-and-so's friend, man, could really use some help, or could use a reference, perhaps. Could you do me, you know, the spot so we can help out this individual? You talking about your gay friend? Right? You talking about your gay cousin? You know. People really talk like this. And back then, it was accepted. Matter of fact, it was actually mandated, depending on where you were. And say, you know, what type of people you hung around and how educated they were or how educated they were not. You know, to talk about, you know, HIV and AIDS and sexually transmitted diseases at all, let alone homosexuality, let alone bisexuality. Impossible. Virtually impossible. I mean, to just even have it mentioned, I've known fellas that were straight who even to try to talk about it with their girlfriends, you know, or their wives, you know, got them to be, you know, they put them in a light where they were questioned, right? Where their sexuality was questioned, where they were tested, you know, just for, you know, trying to talk about it. So, you know, now that people have realized that, you know, the prison system is a main spreader of this shit, and TB and hepatitis and a bunch of other goddamn things, and, you know, because what's going on in there, whether it's willful or not, you know, this is a fucking reality. And what's happened to all these other goddamn people in these detention centers? And they're not giving you fucking health care. That's a lie that they're giving them fucking health care. They give them just enough health care not to spread a fucking plague. But do you really think if their fucking teeth falls out that these motherfuckers give a shit? They don't care. You think these if somebody has prostate cancer, some shit, they're going to fucking help? They don't care. They don't care. You know, there's a lot of talk, but they don't care. And then, that's one thing we can talk, you know, about before we go. This fucking ISIS. When are they going to really do something about ISIS? I mean, seriously. And when I say they, I'm talking about all the motherfuckers who make decisions. You know, ISIS is their goddamn problem. But see, it's their problem because they fucking created the conditions that made these motherfuckers. You know, it's the same thing with the fucking Taliban. When the Mujahideen were destroying the Buddha statues in Afghanistan. Because, you know, people got it all twisted. You know, they think of the Buddha as a big fat guy from China. No, you got it wrong. That's Hotai. You got it wrong. And I'm saying that specifically because there's a lot of black folks to get real fucking uptight with you and shit. When, you know, Buddha was a god. Nope, wrong. Yes, he was. No, he wasn't. And it's like, you know, no, you got it wrong. Because your religion tells you, your religion's not telling you shit about the Buddha. Nothing about the Buddha. Zero, zilch, nada, nothing. Nicta, nothing. This is a conspiracy you've made up in your own fucking mind. You know, somebody said some shit to you, you don't investigate it, and you run with it. And see, and this is what happened with ISIS. This is even what happened, as far as I'm concerned, with the Crips and the Bloods. You know, you fucking create a goddamn condition. You know, well, in this case, you create racism. And then the Black Panther Party comes around in Oakland to deal with the racism. They take a militant stance because of the militant stance of the police, right? This is the 60s. You had the Weather Underground in the United States. You had the Angry Brigade and shit going on in the UK. So, you know, not that the Black Panther Party had anything to do with that. They were not involved in that type of violence. If anything, they were framed to make it seem as if they were involved in that type of activity when that really wasn't the case. Yeah, they had connections with these people politically in a lot of ways, but, you know, they were not involved in that jazz. You know, Fred Hampton, before he was assassinated, and this is a real assassination that occurred on U.S. soil. Look up COINTELPRO, Fred Hampton, and the trial for who killed Fred Hampton, okay? And, you know, you tell me. Fourth World Radio at gmx.pt. Number 4. TH World Radio. One word. At gmx.pt. Let me know. Or hit me up on Twitter. at the Angry Indian. You know, and you tell me what you know, that. Really, what do you think? You know, I mean, again, you know, I feel that I'm redundant, and this is why it goes in these tangents like this, because how many times, how many different ways can you say the same fucking thing? You know, how many different ways can you say that Israel is a genocide state? It is. It is. They've made it very clear. They intend to get rid of every goddamn Palestinian that, you know, dares to identify as a Palestinian. That's the bottom fucking line. Even though, like, Netanyahu, like Golda Meir, who was from Cleveland or some shit, you know, they are claiming this place as theirs. Of course, there were always Jews living there. But, you know, that's like saying that one or two fucking, you know, major family groups or a couple of neighborhoods, that this represents the whole of Judea. You know, no, get the fuck out of here, man. That represents every Jew in the world. You know, I mean, it's always what they do. You know, they'll take one example that they like and say, well, hey, you know.
This motherfucker says that Indian people, this, that, and the other. And it's like, well, that's what he says. You know, and especially in the Native community, you always have to preface everything you fucking say is, well, I'm not speaking for anybody but myself. You know, I mean, we're all so fucked up now. We can't talk. We can't talk. I mean, look at Sean Penn. He made a fucking comment. And you know what? If you don't like what he said, you shouldn't listen to this show, because I probably would have said the same fucking thing he did. You can go look it up about the Mexican director who won for something, because I didn't watch the awards. And he was like, yo, man, you know, he's the type of, you know, cat they don't want to give a green card, or something to that effect. And he was right. Even the director said he was right. He was right. Now, I heard Mario Lopez and a bunch of, you know, pochos and shit got mad and fucking wanted to argue about this. But see, y'all will sing fucking nigga, nigga, nigga all the goddamn time and then ask me why I have a fucking problem. That's real shit, man. And it don't make no motherfucking sense to, you know, to be that goddamn sensitive about that shit, you know, when you're fucking sitting around. I mean, what? How many of you are fucking, you know, even how many of you are indigenous and don't want to goddamn admit it in the Spanish speaking, quote unquote, Latino community? Because Latinum doesn't exist any fucking more. And it's really goddamn amazing that Spanish, I mean, Spanish is only spoken in fucking Spain, in Europe. And, you know, it's the major goddamn language in South America, except Brazil, where the Portuguese were. And that also is a Romance language. And now, you know, and this is one thing, and this is not a knock, because see, somebody's going to get mad that I'm saying this. One time I lost 200 some odd motherfucking subscribers because I said I don't believe in an open door fucking immigration policy. I don't. You know, I am of the fucking opinion that just like the cat that Sean Penn was referring, because I don't remember his name and I didn't see the movie. I don't even know what the fuck the movie's about. That's not the point, you know, but he was like, you know, Mexico deserves a good government. He's right. Why isn't that the discussion? Why are we not discussing how the banks and bullshit are laundering money for, you know, all kinds of criminality here in the United States? I mean, they've been fined for it. Wasn't Citibank part of that bullshit? Used to be Citibank National, and they used to fucking do business with the Nazis. So, I mean, this isn't a big fucking surprise. This is not a big fucking surprise. And, you know, you really got to consider for a moment that, you know, the discussion about Mexico is about immigration, always. Immigration y drogas, right? Nothing else. Nothing else. You know, we don't talk about the human rights fucking crisis going on the border there. We got indigenous women disappearing on the Mexican border, and we got indigenous women missing on the Canadian border. But we're not going to fucking discuss that. And we're not going to discuss how every fucking Mexican government that has been in existence, at least since John F. Kennedy any goddamn way, has kowtowed to the American government. Not that they can do any fucking thing about it. I mean, it's just like with Canada. Canada's right the fuck next door. It's supposed to be the, you know, what? Within the province of Britain still, right? But, you know, what the fuck, man? I mean, you go to Victoria, you see, you know, pictures of the Queen and shit, you know, of Elizabeth. But what the fuck? they can't, their own fucking spies say that they have no autonomy and shit, that they have to take whatever the fuck they're told to do with a fucking smile and shit. And unlike the rest of us, with some grease, whatever the hell is asked of them, you know, which is one of the scandals that broke out about this whole fucking thing with Israel, because it didn't come from the, it, well, the cable or whatever it is came from the Israeli Mossad, but that's not who leaked it. You know, it came from, well, we're assuming South African security, right? One of them, I think they got like 3-5 goddamn agencies and shit. So, you know, like everybody else, what is it, 16, 18 in the fucking U.S., more than that? When you say loops, more than that? Britain's got what? We only know about 5 and 6 because of the movies. I mean, you still can't even get information on a special operations executive, and that was goddamn World War II. You know, so it's like, no, man, come on. Australia, New Zealand, there's spies all over the goddamn place. I mean, see, that's one of the other things that people haven't really thought about. Since this whole war on terror shit has started, since the Bush-Cheney political criminal conspiracy to undermine the American equilibrium, you know, that there was, you know, what? You had what you needed to have, right? You had what you needed to have. Or at least what, I mean, come on, what? You got the fucking DOD, you got the NSA, you got the CIA, you got the FBI. What am I missing? I mean, DIA, right? I mean, there's all this, you know, alphabet soup of fucking intelligence agencies and shit, but they can't seem to stop the neo-Nazis that are running around the fucking country, you know? Or at least they can't do enough to fucking prevent this shit from spreading. You know, lead the same type of anti-terrorism. What are they calling it? You know, the winning hearts and minds and shit to prevent terrorism in our country. How come they don't go to you know, the white communities and do that? Well, see, they wouldn't, because the Republicans have a goddamn conniption, you know, because the last time they tried, they even said that the white supremacists in this country were a fucking security threat, which they say that they're a fucking security threat, because they are a goddamn security threat. The fucking Republicans went nuts. They went nuts in the Congress, they went nuts in the fucking Senate, right? They were accusing Obama of an anti-white crusade and all this type of shit, and it's like, wait a minute, so you're saying that to say that the Klan is a fucking problem, a domestic fucking security problem, is to say that that's an anti-white crusade? Why don't you just come out, Mr. Senator, Mr. or Mrs. Congressperson, and say, I support the fucking Ku Klux Klan because I'm a white supremacist? See, why don't we just put all the fucking cards on the table? All of you fucking people who think that Obama was born in Kenya or some shit, you know, or like Dr. Ben Carson, right? Dr. Ben Carson. You know, he's a fucking nobody. I don't give a fuck how many people he operated on. I think the man is goddamn insane. You can be functionally fucking insane. You know, I don't know why folks don't understand that. And I think that has a lot to do with the lack of education in the U.S. Because you can be functionally fucking crazy. I mean, Jeffrey Dahmer kept a fucking job, all this kind of shit, and was on a fucking killing spree. How long did he do this? H.H. Holmes, if you guys are into the fucking serial killer nonsense. I mean, well, how many fucking bright bastards are running around fucking doing these things? And they go on year after fucking year, attack after fucking attack. They only get caught because somebody made a mistake, you know, in terms of just being lazy or not paying attention. And they get caught. I mean, that's how they got that freak over in on, I don't know where this was in New York City. I heard it was like the white areas of New York City, because black women were panicking until they realized that he wasn't coming after black women. New York City. The Son of Sam. The Berkowitz motherfucker. Yeah, him. I mean, you know, he made a mistake. He made an error, and that's how they found him. But he was going on for the longest. They didn't fucking know. I mean, you know, the papers on it, mostly because it was sensationalized. But it didn't mean that they were actually looking for this son of a bitch. And then, you know, that got tied up in the whole fucking satanic panic, which, you know, even the Bureau admits was complete bullshit. And, you know, people went to jail. People lost their fucking businesses, lost their homes, lost their families. It's trying to be fucking nonsense, because a bunch of fucking paranoid conservatives who don't know how to just... I don't know what the fuck y'all's problem is. And I really hope that there's a pill for it. I
really do. I really fucking do. So, yeah, you know, I'm sorry I really didn't have too much to fucking talk about and went everywhere any goddamn way. But, hey, we're going to have some special audio for you about, yeah, because I remember Newt fucking Gingrich, and we're going to play that. You know, because, you know, for those of you who are thinking about voting Republican, goddamn think fucking twice. This is the Angry Indian. You're listening to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
We have one more question. Yes, ma'am.
What do you attribute to the fact that we haven't been hit since 9/11?
Why have we not been hit by since 9/11, which is a good question. My first answer is I honestly don't know. I would have expected another attack, and I particularly thought, I was very, very worried and talked to the administration when we had the sniper attacks, because the sniper attacks were psychologically so frightening to the average person because of their randomness, that I thought, I was amazed that the bad guys didn't figure out how to send 10 or 12 sniper teams. I think there are a couple things, though, that we tend not... This is, by the way, one of the great tragedies of the Bush administration. The more successful they've been at intercepting and stopping bad guys, the less proof there is that we're in danger. And therefore, the better they've done at making sure there isn't an attack, the easier it is to say, well, there was never going to be an attack anyway. And it's almost like they should every once in a while have allowed an attack to get through just to remind us. But I mean, think about the psychology. You know, why did we wrap up so many people? Well, because we wiretapped. And again, I'm going to be a little controversial. I would divide the FBI into two agencies. I would have an anti-domestic crime FBI, which was very cautious, very respectful of civil liberties. You were innocent until proven guilty. And I would have a small but very aggressive anti-terrorism agency. And I would frankly give them extraordinary ability to eavesdrop. And my first advice to civil libertarians is simple. Don't plot with terrorists.
This is Malachi Daniels, talking to you from New York City. You're listening to Aboriginal News, Angry Indian Radio, a place where you can come to hear what's really critical and discussed about African people, about Indigenous people, what is going on globally. Where you can come and get real information. This is not CNN. This is not even RT or STB. This is Aboriginal News. Come and get it.
I'm George Bavard. Suppose you're eating with a friend and he suddenly begins to choke. Would you know what to do? If he can cough, leave him alone. Don't pound on his back. But if he can't cough, talk, or breathe, or if he only makes a high-pitched wheezing sound, you must take action. Here's what to do. Move behind your friend and put your hands like this, right between the navel and the rib cage. Then pull sharply in and up as many times as necessary. What's happening is this. The food is acting like a cork in a bottle. When you pull into the stomach, you force the trapped air to pop the cork out. You can even do this to yourself, using the back of a chair or your own fist. It's simple, but it can save lives. The Will Rogers Institute has a free booklet about this technique and the variations you should use for pregnant women. It also shows how to reduce the chances of choking, especially for children. For your free copy, write The Will Rogers Institute, White Plains, New York.
Would you like to hear the lie that judges tell jurors every day?
Listen up. This matters. I'm Lewis Black, and this is the Civil Liberties Minute with ACLU attorney Bill Newman.
In a criminal case, the judge instructs the jury, you decide the facts, but you jurors must apply to those facts the law as I explain it. And if the prosecution has proven the defendant's guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, then you must return a verdict of guilty. The problem with this instruction? It's not true. It's not true at all. And the judge well knows that, but most jurors don't. Jury nullification, the right of jurors to say no, to just say no to a prosecution, was central to the Bill of Rights. Indeed, Thomas Jefferson famously believed that jurors' right to nullify was central to democracy. Writing in the Champion magazine recently, criminal defense attorney Patrick Barone cautions that care must be taken when considering nullification because juries can use that authority to enhance and augment the power of the elite rather than to limit it. But, Barone continues, jury nullification can and should be a critical limitation on legislatures bent on promulgating and judges bent on enforcing ever more overreaching criminal laws. The take-home lesson here, criminal juries should know of their right to nullify because that power can constitute liberty's last defense.
The Civil Liberties Minute is made possible by the American Civil Liberties Union because freedom can't defend itself.
Every day, one more Aboriginal person will test positive for HIV. Some will be rejected by their family, friends, and community. They will live in isolation, their voices no longer heard. HIV/AIDS stigma and discrimination denies our people the right to protect their future. You can make a difference. Be their voice.
Hey everybody, it's Dr. Vibe, the host and producer of The Dr. Vibe Show at thedrvibeshow.com. At our show, we do conversations and provide information for Black men and those who love them. So come check us out. Also at iTunes, and also selective episodes are featured at the Good Men Project, one of the most viewed websites in the world for men. So find out about Black men and those who love them at the Dr. Vibe Show.
I'm Dick Gregory with PETA. Martin Luther King Jr. taught me the fight against oppression is never an easy one. It's even harder if you have no voice. For animals held captive in circuses, life consists of cramped cages, shackles, and daily beatings. There is no escape. They cannot demand their freedom. Images like these bring only one word to my mind, slavery. Be an abolitionist for the animals. Please don't go to circuses. For more information, contact PETA.
757-622-PETA.
Hey, this is Ra LaMata.
And Donna from APSI.
And you're listening to a
Creative Commons licensed podcast.
Word.
I'm proud to present to you tonight Michael Parenti. Yeah!
Really, really nice to be here. Has it really been 25 years? You know, it's very depressing, isn't it, Will, that the children of your students are now your students. Isn't that right? On the other hand, it's very inspiring to know that we have another whole generation and the struggle goes on and continues. And that's what really bothers the powers that be, that they have to deal with these human beings who have thoughts and interests of their own. And that's always a problem. One of the great assets they have on their side is the media. Yes, the title is The Hidden Ideology of the News Media, or the Mass Media. But it's so well hidden that the media themselves will maintain they don't have an ideology. They report only the truth. We goes out there, we gets the story, and we writes it. That's how a reporter said it to me. They have no selectivity, no biases. So you have these two basic myths. One is that it's a free and independent press. Two, it's that it's an objective press. We also have a third one, which has become a predominant one, reflective of the conservative domination of the media, namely that it's a liberal media. The idea, the charge that the media is biased in a liberal way, is well known to most Americans. The charge I'm going to make tonight that the media is biased in a right-wing corporate America way is a view not as well known. Which itself, you see, bespeaks of the bias of the media. The reason the first is so well known is because that's what the conservatives want you to know. The reason they're able to get you to know is because they so dominate the media. They so dominate the media that they can convince you that it's the liberals who dominate the media. Did you get that? I haven't lost anybody yet, all right? It's too early in the talk to lose you. Let's actually look at the media. One of the remarkable things about the commentators in the media is they go from far right to moderate center. You have the Rush Limbaughs, the Bob Inuses, the Bob Grants, or whatever their names are, the Shop Jocks. You've got the McLaughlins. McLaughlin has three shows on television. Don McLaughlin, this gruff right-winger, National Review editor. You have William Buckley, you have The Evening with David Brinkley, you have Evans and Novak, and others and others. You get a range of discussion that goes from far right, as I say, to a pale, skittish, centrist, moderate, liberal view, which has always been addressing itself up on the right. Rush Limbaugh has, for instance, 600 radio stations. Ralph Nader, who was around 25 years before Rush Limbaugh, who had done nationally known investigative work, his commentaries get on very few radio stations. He has a newspaper column he writes. It gets into 20 newspapers. Conservative columnists, their columns are syndicated on an average of 200 to 450 newspapers around the country. So that's the way it goes. There are well-financed right-wing media watch organizations. Reed Irvine. Now, Reed Irvine I've debated a couple of times on panels, and he keeps talking about liberal media and how conservative views are shut out of the media. So you've got all these conservatives all over the media talking about a liberal media. And if you call up and you say, what's so liberal about it when they got people like you all over it? Actually, stations are awash with your commentaries. Irvine, for instance, I said conservative viewpoints are shut out of the media. You have a radio show that's aired on 120 stations. He said, 200. His ego was such that he was actually strengthening my argument when he wanted to get the right number. I said, you have a newspaper column that appears in over 90 newspapers. He says, it's 100. I said, well, there's a lot of us on the left, us liberal, progressive, left, radical, Marxist, whatever, all the various variations. A lot of us would love to be shut out in that manner. We really would. Not to be overlooked is the National Empowerment Television, or NET. It's a new cable network. It's available in all 50 states. It offers round-the-clock conservative political commentary nonstop. Newt Gingrich has a show. Hey, there's one you don't want to miss. In the words of its founder, Paul Weyrich, NET is dedicated to countering media news that is riddled with a far-left political bias and unacceptable notions about gender norming, racial quotas, global warming, and gays in the military. These are the mortal dangers that he's facing. I'll quote you David Bergen. David Bergen is editor-in-chief of the Oakland Tribune, out near where I live in the Bay Area, California now. And this is what Bergen says. And this is very interesting because this comes from an editor-in-chief of a mainstream newspaper. And he says, the greatest myth in America, or one of the top five at least, is the notion of the liberal press. That is such a crock. By the way, one thing about some newsmen is there, you're impressed by their eloquence of phrasing. That is such a crock. And the media bashing based on this so-called liberalness, Bergen goes on, that guys like Limbaugh get away with attacking. You know what? In all the years I've worked for newspapers, and the total is 18 or 19 of them, I have never worked for a liberal newspaper. Not one. There's only a half dozen in the entire country. There are some 1,700 daily newspapers, and they're all run by Republicans. Why? Because Republicans are the kind of people who own things. He left out a variable there. The rich are the kind of people who own things, and they tend to be Republican. That's why. And I don't know one of them who's going to let some liberal run his newsroom. It ain't going to happen. Well, who owns the big media, the mainstream media that reaches millions of people? The press lords who come to mind are right-wing conservatives or moderately right, maybe. William Randolph Hearst, Henry Luce, Rupert Murdoch, who describes himself not as a conservative, but as a radical conservative, meaning a very extreme sense conservative, Sulzberger, Annenberg, people of markedly conservative hue, who, by the way, leave their ideological imprint on the editorial news. Sulzberger used to call up the editorials for the next morning that were going to go in the New York Times, and he would go into them. He's the publisher, right, and directly going in and interfering, and sometimes even on the front page. His son is taken over. Punches, the old man is retired. The young one is even more conservative. He says he meets with his editorial board every day. Rupert Murdoch, who probably owns more media in the world than any other individual, owns almost all the media of Australia, was an Australian, came to the U.S., found there were restrictive laws against how much media a non-U.S. citizen can own, so he became a citizen within a month. Most people have to wait a number of years, you know, green card, residency, all that stuff. He got it like that, and owns enormous numbers of newspapers and TV stations. He was interviewed once. Interview was carried in Vanity Fair. The question was, you're considered to be politically conservative. To what extent do you influence the editorial posture of your newspapers? And I thought you'd get that usual blather about, well, of course, I respect the editorial integrity and independence and professionalism of my editors and blah, 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 blah. He didn't say anything like that. He responded with rather refreshing candor. He said, to what extent do I influence my editorial policies of my newspapers? Considerably. My editors have input, but I make the final decision. That's very refreshing, you know, when they come right out and they say what really happens. I do it, understand? You do what I say because I control your career, your job. And my control of your job and your salary gives me control of your mind, too. And if there's some kind of incongruity there and clash, then your mind goes out the door with your butt, you see. The boards of directors of print and broadcast news organizations are populated by representatives from Ford, General Motors, General Electric, General Dynamics, Dow Corning, Alcoa, Coca-Cola, Philip Morris, ITT, IBM, AT&T, and other corporations. So these boards are filled with the representatives of corporate America. That's your free and independent media. You see, the media in this country are not close to corporate America. They're not friendly to corporate America. They're not inclined or biased toward corporate America. They are corporate America. They are multinational giant corporations, and their boards are inhabited with the same people who inhabit the boards, these interlocking directorates who inhabit the boards of all the other giant corporations and come from these other corporations. Among the major stockholders of the three largest broadcast networks are Chase Manhattan, J.P. Morgan, and Citibank. NBC is owned by General Electric. CBS is owned by Tisch. ABC capital cities is owned by Disney. GE and Disney are the two of the most conservative corporations that exist. Fox Network is owned by Rupert Murdoch. What's the free independent media we're talking about? And these people appoint the presidents of the corporations, who appoint the bureau chiefs, who appoint the top editors, who appoint the reporters. If you look at the organization of any news organization, it looks like the army, top-down command right down along the way. And their profits are as high as anything in corporate America, and the degree of merger and concentration is higher than it is in finance capital and in manufacturing capital. The media are highly profitable, highly concentrated. Given that distribution of ownership, it's not surprising that labor is regularly downplayed, the concerns of labor. In this last election, for instance, you remember the AFL-CIO said, we're going to get political. We're going to go out there and we are pledging, the story got around all the media, $35 million we will spend in the campaign. And suddenly the terms were being revised. Big labor is influencing, flexing its muscles in the campaign. They're going to spend $35 million. You could not have missed it. It turned out they spent about $25 million. But it was all over the media about big labor. Let me tell you something, folks. That in the state of California and in the state of Florida, there were corporations that spent $40, $50, $60 million in California to defeat a single-payer health program for the citizens of the state of California, in Florida to defeat protection of the wetlands and environmental laws. They spent more money to defeat little state propositions on the ballot in those states for a few propositions, than labor spent in all over the country. But you wouldn't have known it. There were no big headlines about big capital. You heard about big labor. Did you hear about big capital spending 10 times more than anybody else? For both parties, buying politicians of all stripes and wedding them to their way? The concerns of labor are your concerns. They're the concerns of ordinary working people. They're the concerns about wages, they're the concerns about work conditions, they're the concerns about job opportunities, the concerns about consumer safety, occupational safety, environmental protection. Those are the things that labor unions, especially the more progressive labor unions, have been fighting for and talking about for years. You wouldn't know it. It's not in the business-owned media. You've got a business section. Go buy a newspaper tomorrow and pick up that newspaper. You'll find a business section for that 2, 3, 4% that own about 80% of the capital in America? Where's the labor section? Where's the labor news? Where are the concerns of working people? Jonathan Tassini, head of the National Writers Union, my union, I'm a member of it. I'm a writer, I thought I'd unionize, why not? I believe in it. He studied all reports dealing with workers' issues carried by ABC, CBS, NBC, Evening Television News, during one whole year. And he defined labor issues rather widely. It included a few consumer issues and child care issues. It came to only 2.3% of total coverage. We're not even talking about how they were covered, just that there was even any mention. 2.3% of the total news coverage was for labor's issues. For that 120 million people who worked for a living, 140 million, whatever it is now. No wonder another survey found that only 6% of business leaders in America thought that media treatment accorded them was poor, while 66% said it was good or excellent. Another influence on the media, a conservative influence, are the corporate advertisers. They exercise a considerable influence. Todd Gitlin interviewed these network bosses and said, to what extent was entertainment TV, so to what extent do your advertisers influence your decisions regarding what you put in your programs? And again, I thought you'd hear the usual blather of, well, it can be a pressure occasionally, but that's the exception. We have our individual standards and all that. Every one of them said, all the time. To what extent? We always keep them guys know. Are you kidding? Those are our accounts. Are you kidding? They pay the bills all the time. You bet you. We watch out all the time as to what bothers them or doesn't bother them. In fact, a lot of our programming isn't for you. It is to please our advertiser. It's not to please the public, necessarily. And often the advertiser does come in and threatens and cancels accounts, not generally because their product is being poorly reflected, but more often because they perceive that there are liberal tendencies creeping into news reports and commentaries or into the particular shows, whatever else. Religious media manifests the same imbalance. How many of us have heard of the Christian Right? I bet everybody has. They have a whole network, the Christian Broadcasting Network, CBN, Pat Robertson. They have several $1 billion worth of media. They have hundreds of radio stations. 10% of all radio outlets in America are controlled by the Christian right-wingers. 14% of the nation's television stations are owned and controlled by the Christian right-wingers. Have you ever heard of a Christian left? There happens to be a very substantial Christian left in America. Liberation theology. People who believe in progressive reform. People who believe that the word of Christ means the social gospel. That you live Christ out in the street. That you find and you work with other people in need and you work for social justice. Where are they? They don't own any networks. That's right. Because big money doesn't back a Christian right. They consider them communist. They consider a Christian left communistic. Big money backs the Christian right and gets them out there in the media, and those are the people who are heard, those are the people who get the subscriptions, those are the people who then rally the souls. A favorite conservative hallucination is that the public broadcasting system, PBS, is a leftist stronghold. There are a few occasionally good documentaries on PBS, although two of the very best that I can recall, which won Academy Awards, Deadly Deception and Panama Deception, both won Academy Awards for full-length documentary features, have never appeared on PBS except one or two local stations. In fact, more than 70% of PBS's primetime shows are funded either completely or in major part by four giant oil companies. No wonder we often refer to PBS as standing for Petroleum Broadcasting System. PBS public affairs programs are underwritten. Remember, you know when they say our underwriters? You watch PBS, don't you? Occasionally, our underwriters are. This is such a genteel term. They mean advertisers. Our filthy rich corporate advertisers are. They don't want to come right out and say that. Are. General Electric, General Motors, Metropolitan Life, PepsiCo, Mobil, Payne Weber, Exxon, and the like. A study of these shows by one media watchdog group, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, found that corporate representatives constituted 44% of the sources about the economy. Public interest advocates accounted for 3%, while labor representatives were virtually shut out and non-existent. Another thing is the appearance of false diversity, I would call it. I think I call it, in Inventing Reality, I call it false balancing. You can watch a talk show or a panel, and there'll be two, three, four people. You watch Nightline, you said, we have so-and-so from here, we have so-and-so from there, and they'll get into arguments with each other, and you can sit there, and you are being reassured. You see, there is openness and diversity in our media, difference of opinion. I heard a debate one time on the David Brinkley show. It was between, one of them was Elliot Abrams, and I forget who the other guy was. Abrams was in the State Department. He wasn't in the Pentagon, so it wasn't Abrams. It was that guy named Perez. And I forget the other fellow's name. One of them was arguing that the escalated level of defense spending under the Reagan administration, up to almost $300 billion a year, was sufficient, and the escalation was a good thing. The other one was arguing that the escalation was a good thing, but we should escalate even more and spend still more in defense spending. So those were the two sides of the argument. And it reminds you that, you know, when you hear two sides of an argument, you're not hearing all sides of an argument. And so, again, you see that whole other part of the spectrum, that whole public interest, progressive left part, has been amputated and thrown out of the picture. Crossfire is a very good example. Michael Kinsley against Pat Buchanan. And Michael Kinsley had a moment of truth. He said something that was very, very true. He said as follows. If you watch Crossfire, they say, on the left, Michael Kinsley. On the right, Pat Buchanan. They have new people now, I know. I try not to watch that show. I've been on it twice. It's a screaming feast, you know. You sit there and you got one conservative here, screaming. You got the other one here screaming. And the left that day was Tom Brandon, who really looked almost like he was giving up the ghost. They just sit there and go, well, I don't know, gee. And the right was Robert Novak. And I finally turned to Robert Novak. I said, are you going to let me finish a sentence, or is this a screaming match? He said, you'll finish a sentence, but first we have to cut for commercial. You know? And this is the way it is. And try to develop a thought is impossible. So you just scream it. No, that's not true. Yes, it is. No, it is. And that sort of thing. This is what passes for discourse, for the universe of political discourse in a democratic citizenry. We're supposed to be informed and make up our minds about certain things looking at this kind of thing. Did I tell you what Kinsley said? Or I forgot. You're not the only one getting old. We're okay. Kinsley made this point. He said, Buchanan is much further to the right than I am to the left. And that's exactly the point, you see. That what passes for the liberal or left opinion is really a skittish, very nervous, centrist position that's constantly dressing up its right, that's constantly worrying that it might not be seen as too far out here, which is not the right. The right goes as far right as it wants to go. So then even what passes for liberal opinion in the media must take place within a conservative framework. Not surprisingly, then, public discussion is heavily skewed to the right. On foreign affairs, the media's role as cheerleader of the national security state and free market capitalism is without restraint. Virtually no positive exposure has ever been given to an indigenous third world revolutionary or reformist struggles, or to protests at home and abroad against U.S. overseas interventions. U.S. military undertakings in the Vietnam War, the invasion of Grenada and Panama, the Reagan intervention against Nicaragua, the Gulf War massacre, all these undertakings are portrayed as arising from noble, if sometimes perhaps misplaced, intentions. The whole critique, the whole debate during the Vietnam War, I remember, was between those people who said we could win the war and those people who said we could win the war. See? Now, the assumption of the second was if we could, there'd be no argument then, you see. But there wasn't all of us, the millions of us who were out in the streets getting beaten up by the police, getting arrested and all those things, including me, the millions of us who said there shouldn't be a war, whether you could win it or lose it. And the horror of it was that you might even win it. That war was immoral. It was homicidal. It was killing hundreds of thousands of people. We now see 2 million Vietnamese died in that war. The United States killed 2 million Vietnamese. The Nazis killed, you know, millions of people. We see that as a horrible thing. This was seen in our media as well-intentioned struggle, but it went awry. The Vietnamese weren't ready for democracy, it seems. We tried to bring them democracy with those B-52s and napalm and rapid fire deployment forces and free fire zones and all that. But the damn fool people just didn't want to come to their senses. You've all heard about Bosnia, haven't you? Who hasn't heard about Bosnia? Raise your hand. Ah, see? Right back there. You could leave. Okay. How many has heard about Mozambique? You've heard about people dying in Bosnia. You've heard about people dying in Rwanda. Well, in Mozambique, there was something like 1 million people died. In Angola, there was something like 3 million in wars that were being fought, financed by the CIA. Not a word about it. The massive killings and slaughters that went on by mercenary forces throughout the country, the atrocities, unspeakable stuff, it went on for years. Within a six-month period, 600,000 people killed in Angola. Not a word about it, because the media didn't talk about it. So you see, they may not predetermine what you think, but what they do is they can prefigure what we think about. We talk about those things, maybe not exactly the way they might want us, but they seem to set the agenda for what we believe is important. And when you ask about all these other issues, they'll say, well, look, you know, we have a limited amount of time and space. We just can't cover everything. We have to be very selective and careful, and we've got to compress and condense things. Isn't that right? Haven't you noticed that selective, compressed, and condensed story just recently about the Heavenly Gate cult? Right? Wasn't that compressed and condensed? It was only about a week of 24 hours a day. We had interviews of relatives of friends who knew somebody who had been close to someone else who was in the cult. interviews of stock boys who worked in stores where cult members had shopped in, they think, you know. Right? I mean, really, this is the media that doesn't have enough time to cover everything. And they went on and on and on about these things. Meanwhile, not a word about Mozambique. One of the ways in which the media serve as the stenographers for power, or the mouthpieces for power, is the way they so eagerly and quickly, as if on cue, demonize a foreign leader who might be targeted by U.S. military intervention. I'll give you three examples in recent years. By recent years, I mean from the 1980s and 1990s. Gaddafi of Libya, Noriega of Panama, and Saddam Hussein of Iraq. Now, what those three leaders had in common is, in their quite different ways, were charting a rather independent course for their country. These three guys were demonized within a matter of weeks, you know. Gaddafi, I remember, Libya. I go around talking, people would be Gaddafi, and what about Gaddafi? What about Gaddafi? Gaddafi. Gaddafi, go and get your mama. Gaddafi, under your bed, watch out. Gaddafi. I say, what are you preoccupied by Gaddafi? There's one reason you're preoccupied by Gaddafi. Not because he's a threat to you, but because the media has been pumping you with stories about him. 2 months ago when they weren't doing this, nobody was you weren't talking about Gaddafi. You were going to bed, going to sleep, had a nice night. You didn't worry if he was under your bed or not. Now you're Gaddafi. And when they stop talking about him, you'll stop worrying about him again. It's kind of scary. I remember that with Saddam Hussein. Saddam Hussein was CIA. He was put in Iraq by the CIA. He was a right-wing military guy. He exterminated the Kurdish Independent Party. He exterminated the Iraqi Communist Party. I mean, this guy was not particularly good news. But he also did some other things. He was developing the country. He trained a whole cadre of engineers. He put out an education plan. And he was fighting for an independent course on the oil pricing. And that was his mistake. And Bush went after him. So we now find even a conservative nationalist, if he's an independent nationalist and doesn't act like a purely comprador ruler, that is, a ruler who is a client state leader of U.S. corporate American imperialism, the kind of ruler who says, come on in, boys, it's all yours, do what you want with the country, there's no development, there's no occupational safety laws, there's no minimum wage laws, there's no unions, or they're very small, very weak, if they get out of line, we'll beat the hell out of them with our civil guard, our guard who are trained, financed, equipped, and advised by you. And you come on in, invest in cheap labor, your profit level, your value-added level, the rates are 3-4 times what they'll be in Ohio or California. Close your factory there. Come on here. Open it up here. It's all yours. That's the kind of leaders they want. And when they get a leader who charts an independent course, and that's Noriega of Panama, he said, I got $10 million from the CIA. Noriega was CIA. It's no accident that Trujillo, his boss, the military leader who took over in Panama and took back the Panama Canal, and then started all sorts of reforms, human service programs, education for the common people. It's no accident that less than a year after Reagan got into office, Trujillo's plane exploded in midair. A bomb blew him to pieces, and Noriega was put in his place. But Noriega still had, the Panamanian military was a rather progressive one, a nationalist, populist military, and there were limits to what he could do. And when he started refusing to do what the CIA want on drug deals and on anti-Sandinista moves, that's when they went after him. And the media report him as called him a jungle rat. I remember Dan Rathers, the liberal Dan Rathers, saying, Noriega, we call him a swamp rat. The swamp rat, Noriega, crafty and full of guile, like he's an expert on swamp rats. You ever heard of that? So you turn to your fellow Americans, you say, how could a country, Libya, a country with which a short time ago you couldn't even find on the map, headed by a guy whose name we still can't all agree on how to spell or even pronounce, with a population of 3 million, 3 million, and a ragtag army of 50,000, how can that country be a mortal threat to the survival and interests of the United States? It's not a mortal threat to us. It was a threat to the oil companies, that's all. His unspeakable sin was he and his colonels led a colonel's rebellion in 1968 In a country that had a social structure like Saudi Arabia, our wonderful ally Saudi Arabia today, that is a country that had mass poverty and a few obscenely rich families that had hundreds of billions of dollars more money than knew what to do with. He took over that country and he started to use that money for social programs. 40 million trees planted in forestation programs, education programs, health clinics set up, roads put in, and the like. And he nationalized the oil industry. He took it from the big oil companies. He said, the oil is in our land. The people who live on this land should get something for it. He still sells the oil to us at relatively the same price. It's no loss to you and me. The loss is to Exxon and Mobil. Well, for half a century, the CIA and other covert agencies have involved themselves in political assassinations and death squads that have killed tens of thousands of people in Guatemala, El Salvador, Honduras, Bolivia, Colombia, Argentina, Chile, Brazil, and you can go on. And the killings were not random. The killings were of liberation theology clergy, of union leaders, of student leaders, peasant leaders, co-op leaders, and people like this. Anybody who was doing anything to try to organize the ordinary, common, poor people to better their lives, become active social agents of their own lives, those were the people killed. And it's a very rational and very correct policy, because I, who make money and get rich off your labor, want you demoralized and disorganized. I don't want you organized. I don't want you well-educated. I don't want you conscious and informed and militant. I don't want you being able and capable of defending your own interests. The hungrier you are, the more willing you will work for harder and harder for less and less. And the harder you work for less and less, the more I make and the richer I make. For half a century, the CIA has been involved in drug trafficking and alliances. They were involved with the Golden Triangle. They had a whole airplane company. It was called Air America, wasn't it? Air America. It was a CIA-run airplane company directly involved with taking the heroin out and bringing it to that big, rich American market, the first one. Do you know which one that was? It was the GIs in Vietnam. You got 300,000 guys there living on the edge, desperate, bored, homesick, miserable, frightened, and with money. That's a drug market, man. That was the first big drug market the CIA cultivated, was their own American soldiers in Vietnam. It's no accident that so many of those Vietnam vets came back with drug problems. And they had Air America flying it from those hill country Hmong tribes and these others who were supposedly anti-Vietnamese, anti-communist, and they were our allies. I mean, that's a matter of public record, for Christ's sake. Senator Church's committee discovered that in the 70s. Congressman Otis Pike's Joint Congressional Committee in the late 70s. Senator Kerry's committee in the 80s about cocaine from Latin America. Again, the CIA involved. Heroin from Afghanistan. The CIA was involved with that. I know that. You know where I read it? I read it in a secret document. You know what the secret document was? The Washington Post. Right out there, flashed right out there on page 23, paragraph 42. It said, the CIA supported wars proving successful against the Soviets. The Mujahideen are coming back and taking over their lands. And with this, the opium trade has increased. And we can expect an increase in the heroin that has flooded in American cities. I said, isn't that interesting? Just written like that, as if it was a weather report. Can you imagine if that was the Sandinistas doing that, or Libya, or Cuba? My God, it would have been all over the papers for years. Here it was on page 23, paragraph 45, as a couple of sentences. Now, this is all, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, this is all a matter of public record. Three congressional committees have had the guys come forward. Felix Rodriguez comes forward and before the Carey Committee and said, how much did you handle? He said, I handled about $10 million in cash a week. He said, who with? Senator Alphonse D'Amato. D'Amato's elegance and form and style. He said, wow, who with? What'd you do that with? Well, with the executive and military leaders of Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador, Colombia, Venezuela, Mexico. The model says, how'd you get out of those countries with that kind of money? How'd you get past customs? He says, really, Senator, when you're carrying $10 million, you don't go through customs. You know, they have limousines and helicopters waiting for you. And they say, I mean, I saw all this. I saw these guys get up and say, yeah, we got on these planes and we flew down there with guns. And then we loaded up with cocaine and we came back to the city. Came back to the U.S. The interesting slip there, the city. You know, I remember when cocaine was an upper class and upper middle class drug. I mean, it's what New York executives, Hollywood guys used and all that sort of thing. Coke was a chic and expensive recreational drug. Since it was people of a certain class, it was called the recreational drug. Suddenly, in the 80s, it appears on the streets in bargain prices in concentrated form as crack. Goes to all these different inner-city people. And again, they want a African-American population that is not organized, getting militant, getting politically conscious, as it was in the 60s with the Black Panthers and the Young Lords, Chicanos, the Brown Berets, all these different people. They don't want that. They want people who are disorganized, demoralized, drug-ridden, crime-ridden, young men who are not challenging the powers that be because they're too busy shooting each other up with guns and themselves up with needles. And so it worked very well. It also then gave them money to pursue their mercenary forces. This is a story that's been pretty much buried and killed in the media. Gary Webb of the San Jose Mercury News just this past year, again, after years of investigation, this is journalism at its best. This is journalism at its best. Found CIA operatives who said, yes, we worked with Crips and Bloods inner city leaders in L.A., brought the crack in there and took the money out for the CIA. He put all that on the internet, by the way. It got around so much. And look what the media did. They came out and said, there's no evidence for it. There's never been any evidence for this. I mean, just outright blatant lies. Three congressional committees have given you all the evidence in the world. And the media comes in, and when their first line of suppression doesn't work, and the first line of suppression and distortion, the most common line, is omission. You just don't report it. When that doesn't work and the story gets out, gets on the internet, or some other thing happens, or there's demonstrations, or congressional committee decides to do this, or then they come out and they destroy the target. And they say, Webb is not a particularly good journalist, this, that, and that. He has no evidence for it. He thinks the whole CIA, they accused him of having said things he never said. That's the way the media worked. Listen, if that kind of thing went on in some countries, that would be called totalitarian control. Senator Church found that every major news organization and outlet was penetrated by the CIA, that some 400 journalists, editors, and publishers were connected to the CIA. 400, that's a goodly number. There's a massive assault on government human services programs, and this has been given relatively little play in the media, except when it's doing the government's bidding. For instance, the word that's out is that certain things need reform. Welfare needed to be reformed. Now notice the use of certain terms, too. Reform. These are the disinforming euphemisms that are used. Welfare wasn't reformed. It was savaged. It was destroyed. I mean, if I come over to your house and I say, you know, your house needs some rehabbing, needs a little reform, and then I level it with a bulldozer, I mean, wouldn't you be piqued? Wouldn't you feel deceived? And now we hear that same word again, Social Security. We've got to reform Social Security. Why, in 15 years, it'll be bankrupt. Ladies and gentlemen, I remember 1981 when Reagan was in office, and they said, in 15 years, Social Security will be bankrupt. It was running a surplus of $30, $40 billion then. It's still running a surplus today. Of course, they raised the Social Security tax, too. But the point is, it's at least 15 years later, it isn't bankrupt at all. It's 16 years later. It's not bankrupt. It's still running a surplus. It's a lie. But they convince people, they from the beginning, say, well, this is going to happen, and therefore we've got to change it. The truth of the matter is that Social Security is a program that works, and it works very well, and it works for you too. You may think you're too young to worry about it, but when you're in your middle years and trying to raise your own family, do you want parents who are broke, or do you want parents who have some Social Security pension and some means of income for themselves? And Social Security is not just an old age pension. It has three components to it. It has old age retirement support. It has survivor's support for any family of any age. If the breadwinner are killed, one or two, the people who are left destitute or indigent get Social Security. They can be 18 years old and they can collect Social Security. And the third component of it is disability. It has a disability insurance. If you're hit in an accident and you suffer disability and this puts a limit on your earning powers, you can collect Social Security. This is what they want to now dismantle. And the media is going along with it. The media begins by assuming the argument. The very thing that has to be argued and debated is already assumed. And they say, well, we all know that it needs reforming. We all know that it isn't working. It's working perfectly. In 50 years, they've never missed paying out a check. They handle $300 billion a year. And it means the difference between destitution and some measure of dignity for millions of elderly people and hundreds of thousands of disabled people. You'd never know that from the way the media treats that subject. One of the interesting things about the media personnel is the revolving door. They go from government to corporations, back to the media to government. Leslie Gelb was in corporate America, then he was in State Department, then he was at Washington Post, then he's at, I think he's Post, yeah. And now he's back in government. Diane Sawyer, she was with the Nixon administration, and now she's a media personality. She went off with Pat and Dick to California when he retired to help him write his memoirs. And now we see her on ABC. Pat Buchanan. Pat Buchanan was a columnist, a far right-wing columnist. Then he went in and became a speechwriter for the Nixon administration. Then he was out again as a commentator, a journalist. And then he was in with the Reagan administration, and now he's out and he's a journalist again. So he's been either a journalist or a White House flack for his whole life. In other words, in his whole life, he's never had an honest job. Pete Williams. I remember Pete Williams. He was in that film I mentioned to you, Panama Deception, which I'm partial to because I'm in it too. I was being interviewed in that film, and Pete Williams kept coming on. Pentagon spokesman. Now, this is an objective journalist, right? The Pentagon spokesman would say, look, El Chiria neighborhoods in Panama have been bombed by U.S. planes. 3,000 people killed. He says, I have no evidence of that. We'd run, cut in and run footage and you see these houses burning and all that and the bodies lying there. I know of no such atrocities. Pete Williams leaves the Pentagon and he is now national correspondent for NBC. Now, if you had some other country where this was happening, where people were working 1 year for Pravda, the next year for the KGB, next year in the foreign ministry, the next year for Pravda again, why, you'd say, boy, they don't have an independent press. Boy, that's really totalitarian, isn't it? Right. Now, reporters fall into two kinds. When I wrote my book, Inventing Reality, I talked to reporters and interviewed some of them. There are those who will say to you, oh, yes, you have to have very finely attuned antenna as to just how far you could go, and if you go any further, they'll zap you. And then there are others, and usually those were ex-reporters. Those are ones who used to be. With Associated Press, I used to do this, used to do that, and they're no longer doing that. The other ones are the other 97% of the reporters I run into, and journalists and editors and such. They're the ones who get very indignant that you suggest that they are influenced by anything other than their own discerning, independent insight. You see, so are you telling me that I'm not my own man? I'll have you know that in 20 years with this newspaper, I always said what I like. And I answer, you say what you like because they like what you say. And you have no sensation of being repressed because your views are perfectly coterminous with those of your boss. Your unexamined assumptions, your use of terms like reform and swamp rat and whatever else are exactly the kind of stuff they want to hear. It fits. Your ideological perspective is theirs. So you don't have any sensation of restraint. You know, if you have a leash around your neck, but you spend your whole life sitting by the peg, you don't feel restrained. It's only when you try to stray to a forbidden parameter that suddenly you feel the tug. As I felt, why, right on this very campus 25 years ago. Nicholas Johnson gives the case of the four stages of the socialization of a journalist. In stage one, the young, dedicated, idealistic reporter goes out and he investigates something and he writes this expose about local power guys who also happen to be big advertisers for the newspaper, and he comes back and he shows it to his editor, and the editor says, no, that's silly, we can't do that. No, that won't fly. Stage two, he doesn't go out and write it. He gets another idea about something that should be looked into, but he goes talk to the editor first, and the editor says, no, forget it, forget that. Stage three, he gets the idea, and then he dismisses it himself and says, nah, that's silly. And in stage four, he no longer gets the idea, no longer critically looks at that. And I added stage five. Stage five, he gets on panels with media critics like me and gets very indignant if I suggest that there are influencers on him and all that. Well, if it's true that the news is so conservative and so serves the powers that be, why do conservatives keep attacking it as a liberal media? Why not? Keeps it on its toes, keeps it leaning to the right, dressing to the right, keeps it from going too far over to this side. Why not? Of course. And furthermore, for conservatives, for a far-right group, there are things that they don't want to see that are in the regular media. See, if the right-wing ideologues had their way completely, they would want the average newspaper to just be story after a celebration of the free market, the wonders and glories of free market capitalism, a few anti-communist horror stories, lots of crime in there, and then some cooking recipes, crossword puzzle, comics, and all that. Which, by the way, describes a lot of newspapers in America. We used to have one here that attacked me every other day. Burlington Free Press. Is it still around, the Burlington Free Press? We used to call it the Burlington Repress. They had a really terrible right-wing editor in those days named Frank Smith. He was the last editor in America to keep defending Richard Nixon before Nixon left the White House in disgrace for the Watergate thing. The New York Times would run his op-eds because they couldn't find anyone else willing to defend Nixon. That was Frank Smith. There's another problem conservatives do face. To some extent, the media does have to sometimes report hard news. Yeah, even their own ruling elites want to know some things that are going on. And when they report hard news, that gets them sort of close to the real world. And when they get close to the real world, you find that the real world is radical. The real world is leftist. It's not that we, leftists, make up these things. I don't mean that people out in the real world are radical or leftist. I mean the events that we talk about are real. It's not a leftist ideological argument that people are getting downsized and downgraded. It's the real world that's actually happening. It's not a leftist ideological propaganda view that the CEOs and the top 1% of the population are now enjoying a concentration of wealth that's 100% higher than it was 20 years ago. That happens to be an objective fact. We didn't make that up. We only discover it. It's the leftists who want to propagate it and want to publicize it a lot more. It's not a leftist ideological propaganda theme that children in Indonesia, in Guatemala, in El Salvador, in Haiti are working every day for 10, 12 cents an hour, 12 hours a day, that 300, 400 million children in the world are working, children in India, in the sex industry, in carpentry, going blind, going lame, going every other thing without any kind of protection. That's not something we made up. That's something that the right will suppress because it reflects poorly on capital, and that's something that's real and it's out there. And to the extent that the media ever takes notice of a toxic waste dump or something like that, or waste in the Pentagon or something like that, that's when the conservatives say, you see, it's a liberal conspiracy to make corporate America look bad. That's terrible. You shouldn't be talking about those things. And you must talk about them probably because you're a leftist or a liberal. No, they mention it every so often because that's reality. Reality is radical. Well, I think I'm going to wrap it up there. Let me just add that one last question that inevitably comes up. So tell me, Parenti, what do you have, a conspiracy theory? I mean, do you feel there's this small group of people who are plotting this whole thing? I mean, don't you think the force of circumstances, institution, market necessity, that makes things happen? And do you think they actually plan? Do you think there's a small group of men sitting around in a room plotting all this stuff? Somehow that image is supposed to be the most devastating one. That's the one where you're supposed to shrink back and say, oh. Say, oh, no. They don't sit around in a room. They meet on carousels and they go up and down on all sorts of... Or they jump out of airplanes, and as they're free-falling, they talk about the... What about a merger? What about... Of course they meet in rooms. Where the hell else do you think they meet? Of course they meet in rooms. They got lots of rooms. There are rooms in the White House. There are rooms at General Motors. There are rooms at the Bohemian Grove where they go. There are rooms at the Council for Foreign Relations. There are rooms at the Trilateral Commission meetings. There are rooms at the Bilderberg Conference. I looked at the roster list, 1989. I don't want to be a conspiracy theorist. I guess it was 1988 or so, the Bilderberg Conference. Now, this is an international conference of all the elites of various countries, the financial and political elites. Isn't that interesting how economics and politics, the leaders, always seem to get together? There's no conspiracy. Oh, no. But they just happen to go to the same spas and places. And so, of course, I immediately turn to the U.S. page, and I see the first name on the U.S. delegation list is a representative from Rockefeller Brothers Association, David Rockefeller. And the next name on the list puzzled me. I'd never seen it before. It was Honorable Bill Clinton, governor of Arkansas. And I said, what the hell is the governor of Arkansas doing at the Bilderberg Conference? Who's this guy? I didn't know much about Clinton. I knew he had used the National Guard and sent him down to Honduras and all that. Well, you know what happened less than a year and a half later? Why, suddenly the corporate media was saying front runner for the Democratic nomination, Bill Clinton. Interesting. Just a little morsel I want you to be intrigued by. Yes, they do consciously conspire to advance their own interests. You do. School teachers organize and try to get a better deal and try to understand what the policies are, what their options are, what their possibilities are. Farmers organize and do that. The minute you suggest that the ruling elites, the guys who own most of the capital, most of the land, practically all the technology, and control almost all the labor in this country, the minute you suggest that they might be concerned about their interests and try to advantage themselves and propagate it, someone says, well, you got a conspiracy theory? You consciously pursue your self-interests. You wonder about what courses I should take, what should I do this summer, where should I live, can I get that job, this, that, the other thing. What makes you think they don't consciously, willfully pursue their interests and pursue the operational power that is needed to ensure and advance their interests as ruthlessly as they have to? Not directly. They hire people to do the dirty work for them. Well, what is to be done? There's an awful lot to do. You as an individual maybe can do very little, but you can join with others. You can join and work with Spark to help advance and educate and agitate. You can support alternative media. There are a few small radio stations that carry alternative perspectives. There's about 78 of the 9,000 radio stations in America. There's about 78 that are willing to carry my talks now. Support alternative publications like the Monthly Review, Covert Action Quarterly, People's Weekly World, Multinational Monitor, various public interest groups have their own newspapers or newsletters. Peace groups have those important vital information. There's a local alternative newspaper right out here in the back. I'm sorry, Robin, the name escapes me, but it's...
Toward Freedom.
Okay, Toward Freedom. And that's right out there, and you can start educating yourself. You can challenge the mainstream media with letters to the editor, calls to the editors and publishers, call-ins to radio talk shows. I do that. It's getting harder and harder. In the last maybe 15, 20 years, I've had about 5 letters in the Washington Post and about 4 in the New York Times and 2 op-eds in the New York Times, 1 op-ed in the L.A. Times, and rather limited issues or questions, too. But something. And now it's gotten, in the last 5 years, it's harder and harder. But you can still call up and you can still write. And even if they don't run it, they often get worried when they get too much info. When you see something really egregious and deceptive in that way, and above all, we can organize, agitate, educate, and create alternative political movements. George Bush called that class war, when we start to criticize the rich and powerful who abuse us and human labor and the environment. He called that class war. See, whenever we fight back, whenever ordinary people fight back, we're called waging class war. They're doing class war all the time on our heads. The minute we fight back against it, they go, oh, that's class war. You're being divisive, and you mustn't do that.
Yeah, divisive. Just like rebellious slaves were being divisive. That they were being divisive. They were disrupting the beauty and harmony of the magnolia piece of the plantation. And that's us, folks. We can call that class war, this fighting back, this agitating. But I have another word for it also. It is class war, but it's something else. When people act as the active social agents of their own lives, I have another word for that. That's called democracy. Uh-huh. Democracy, democracy, and let's have more of it. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Gullah Geechee Rhythm Radio Station. Hunter Chillin' know this year the head from the body of this year nation and the heart of we station. Queen Quest, come on, Chillin', get involved, get involved, get involved to the Gullah Geechee Sea Island Coalition, the sponsor of this year radio station. Hunter Chillin', this year the we show, Gullah Geechee Rhythm Radio. Come on, y'all.
There are many arguments against the death penalty. It's not a deterrent against the crimes that it punishes. Society who use the death penalty don't have lower crime rates than those that do. When a country abolishes the death penalty, they are not plunged into criminal chaos. But even if the death penalty did reduce crime rates, would it then be acceptable? The death penalty targets the economically disadvantaged. Those who can't afford good legal counsel. Those without a voice in society. There's a saying in the U.S., capital punishment means that those without the capital get the punishment. Statistics show this is true. But would it be acceptable if people from all sections of society were executed? Does killing a rich man make killing a poor man right? The death penalty is irreversible and results in the death of innocence. When someone is dead, a retrospective pardon is of little use to them or their family. Since 1990, in China, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Nigeria, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, Yemen, and the USA, there have been 51 recorded executions of child offenders, some as young as 14 years old. But even if no more innocents or children are killed, should we tolerate the death penalty? The death penalty is never acceptable. It abuses two of our most basic human rights. Everyone has the right to live, and no one shall be subject to torture. The death penalty obviously kills people, but it also tortures, physically by the brutal nature of execution, and psychologically by forcing individuals to wait to be killed. They wait, sometimes for decades, while others are led to their deaths. The horror of this waiting is unimaginable. Human rights are thus called because they apply to all human beings. They belong to all of us equally. An attack on these fundamental rights anywhere is an attack against all of us. The right to life is inalienable. It cannot be given, and it cannot be taken away. No matter how terrible the crime, in a world full of uncertainty, human rights are a clearly drawn line, a line between what is right and what is wrong, the line between imprisonment and execution. Every individual facing the death penalty is, whatever they stand accused of, still a human being. However much we revile them, however much we are outraged by their actions, however much we want revenge, they are still human beings. They may well have killed and tortured. They've crossed the line. But do we really want to join them?
Don't let the colonial occupation blues get you down. Listen to the angry Indian on intelligent Aboriginal radio. The podcast for intelligent Aboriginals.
You are listening to the angry Indian on intelligent Aboriginal radio.